Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices.
Welcome back. This episode, I'm talking to Tim Jasinski. You may remember Tim. He was a guest on the podcast in Season 1, Episode 19. If you missed that episode, definitely go back and check it out. We discussed one of Tim's areas of unique expertise, timber doodles, or AKA the bog stomper. I am so excited because Tim Jasinski has agreed to be back on the podcast with us. And today we're going to be talking about a completely different bird than what we've talked about before. But today, Tim and I are going to be talking about a very specific subject. It is fostering of Canada geese. Tim, welcome. I'm so happy to have you back here.
I'm so excited. This podcast is amazing. I was just telling you, it's so informative for so many different, you know, ways and reasons. It's so helpful. Even if species that we don't do here, I've listened to all of your podcasts, I believe. And it's just so informative. So I'm really honored to be here. This is great.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I've been interviewing and having conversations with so many people who are willing to share their knowledge. And I am so thankful for that. Absolutely so thankful. But talk about spreading, and sharing information. Where I saw, you and I have kind of been chatting on and off, and we've been seeing each other at conferences. And the last conference we saw each other at was the Ohio Wildlife Rehab Association conference, which, by the way, shout out, it was excellent. There's some excellent state conferences out there, and Ohio is one of them. And it was the very first time that I had been to that conference and fell in love. So everybody out there, you need to check it out. You need to become a member, because I'm sure they don't mind if you're out of state and become a member of OWRA. And you need to check out their conference. It is A+ in my book. It was really, really good and really fun to attend.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm on the board now for OWRA, and I'm new this year for the board, but we do a really great conference, and it's really fun because we bring, you know, people from other states. When I saw your name, I'm like, oh yay, Gail's coming. So I was really excited. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was a very fun conference. So
yeah, it was really good. Met a lot of wonderful people. And the talk that I went to, or one of the talks I wanted to make sure I went to, was your talk, your presentation on fostering Canada geese. And as usual, you didn't disappoint. It was amazing. And I wrote down in my notebook, because I'm old school, that right away I'm like, I need to ask Tim back for this, because I think that this is so interesting. And the way you go about doing this demystifies it, I think, for people. And make it kind of reachable, doable for somebody who hasn't done this before. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. This is when we were speaking about this, you know, having the idea to do this. It's something that's so helpful and so good for the bird, and it's so easy. But there are little intricate things that you have to know and do right to make it a success. And we can talk about those things, of course, in this podcast. Yeah. But it's you have to be a goose nerd, and I'm clearly one of those.
Yes, after that presentation, I was absolutely convinced you're a goose nerd.
Yes.
And you've joined the group of goose nerds that, like, I am belong to too. So, because I do love Canada geese as well, they're one of my favorites. So, but for everybody who has not listened to the Timberdoodle/Bog Stomper podcast earlier that we did, can you give everybody a kind of a brief overview of your origin story?
Yeah, so I have been involved with wildlife rehabilitation since I was little, as most of us have done in the past. Mm-hmm. You know, I was, you know, I'm, you know, what, 5, 6, 7 years old, loving wildlife and birds was one of my favorite things I fell in love with. And I would find sick cardinals or house sparrows or pigeons, you know, when I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, and I'd bring them inside and take care of them and let them go. And so that just kind of passion never really ended. No. I've always had, you know, pets as a kid, as an adult. And so it just kind of just never went out of my life. You know, I worked at a pet shop for almost 15 years. That was my first job. And in that, one of my old neighbors actually did rehabilitation. She actually raised raccoons back when Ohio was allowed to do raccoons. And so I met her, and, you know, I've known her for 30 years. And so I just kind of got into the rehab world that way, and specifically doing rescues. So I'm really quick and fast at what I, you know, mm-hmm. catching these animals. And one of the main ones I would catch often was geese. And mm-hmm. this, you know, is just an addition to my love of geese, but it's kind of just worked out where, you know, I remember specifically the woman, Jackie, that got me into this. She's no longer a rehabilitator, but, you know, I still talk to her mm-hmm. and stuff. And she had said she needs help catching a goose with fishing line. So we went to
wait a second. You were catching a goose with fishing line, or the goose had fishing line?
Good point. I was catching a goose that had fishing line attached to its legs.
Okay.
Yes. But I thought that could be possible. We'll talk about that later. But yeah, so this bird was entangled in fishing line. So I had caught the bird before she even got out of the car as we got to the location. So she's like, oh my God, that's insane. How quickly I gotta mess around. So that was the one early memory of doing wildlife mm-hmm. rehabilitation and rescue in more of like a professional sense, because then mm-hmm. there was a friend of hers that did transport for mm-hmm. rehabilitation. So I knew her. And so, you know, she would call me and say, hey, there's an injured Cooper's over here. And so I'd go catch it. And mm-hmm. so then I met the folks at the Medina Raptor Center, you know, in transferring the raptors that were injured mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I kind of got in the rehab community that way. And while I was working at the pet shop, try long story short, I ran into a woman that had a shirt with owls on it. I was like, yeah, I like your shirt. And she's like, oh, cool, you like owls. And so we started chatting, and she said, I volunteer at a nature center. You know, you should be a volunteer there. I'm like, well, let me look into it. So I don't think I went then recently after that talk, but then I was at a local nature center and saw a hairy woodpecker hit a window. Mm-hmm. And so I ran out there and grabbed it. And then I'm like, what do I do with this bird? And so they said, I'll call Lake Erie Nature and Science Center, Bay Village. I'm like, oh, okay. I had talked to a woman that was there. So I brought the bird in there. That was in 2008, I think. Okay. And, you know, I asked the woman that did the intake. I'm like, how do I get a job doing this? And she's like, well, you have to have college and you have to have all this credentials. And I'm like, okay, I don't really have that. And so, mm-hmm. But she said, you can volunteer though. I'm like, oh, okay. So I started volunteering, and then, you know, a couple of years later, I'm full-time staff at the center. So that's the quick, long story short.
It's a perfect story. I mean, it's, you know, it's always a crooked path. That's how I look at it. It was a crooked path for me too. And, you know, your perseverance and interest in wildlife just kept you going at it. And guess what? Yeah, you're full time now. And it is at the Lake Erie Nature and Science Center, right?
Mm-hmm. In Bay Village, Ohio.
There we go. And you guys do, what, about 3,000 animals a year or so?
Yep. About that, we have, because we partake in the Lights Out Cleveland program that rescues, you know, migrant birds that hit windows in downtown Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. we admit all the dead and live birds from that program and actually started that in 2017. And so we collect in that program around 3,000 birds a year on average, with 1,000 of those live. So, the general public, as most rehabilitators don't have the option or resource to go out and do rescues often, the general public brings us around 1,800, 2,000 animals a year. And then the 1,000 live lights out, that's how it equates to around 3,000 animals a year.
Are you strictly birds, or do you do... Are you an equal opportunity rehabilitator? That's what I call myself. So.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, so we're kind of a generalist. So we specialize in waterfowl here and songbirds, but we do pretty much anything that we can handle here at the center. Our center's pretty small. We don't have large flight cages for raptors, so we often will admit those birds, stabilize, and once they're ready for pre-release, we transfer them to local facilities that have larger flight cages that can do the flight work. So we do that. But we do mammals. We don't do nursing mammals here because we're not here long enough throughout the day to properly care for them. You know, especially the cottontails that are, you know, early morning, late evening, and the squirrels that are every 4 hours or 3 hours or whatever.
Right.
Or like the, you know, muscle is like we learned from Peggy Pop's talk, you know, those guys are like really, really high calorie intake needs. So we just don't have an option to do that here properly. Right. So we'll admit, stabilize, and then transfer it right away to another facility that can handle things. So we do a lot of stuff.
Right. And that's great to have a working relationship. So you can do a lot of the intake, but then you can get the animal to where it needs to go for the finishing care and everything. So I think that's just so important to be able to network and work with other rehabilitators and the public, of course, and all of those folks just for the care of these animals. It takes a village. It truly does.
It does. And, you know, like we all are good at, you know, being, you know, general, if an animal comes in, we all pretty much know what to do, stabilize right away. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some people may have a more expertise with osprey, for instance, or, you know, or rails or woodcock or something like that. So, you know, I've always been a good, just, I always wanted to network with other rehabilitators. And, you know, that was one of the things that I really strived for when I first started working here is to network with other rehabbers and talk to them and learn what they do better. And, you know, why would we take care of an animal here that can do better in another place? Cause our, you know, all of our goals here as rehabilitators are getting them back in the wild. So, you know, it may be fun to care for an osprey, sure, but I don't have that, you know, we don't have the expertise here to do that perfectly and properly with an osprey, with a bird that's so specific like that. So I'm so eager to network with other rehabilitators. So that's what I did when I first started working here. And we pretty much talked to most of the centers in the state now with anything. So it's, you know, I'll talk to, you know, Stark Parks in Ohio about chipmunks, or flying squirrels or smaller rodents and, you know, it's so important, I think, for what we do. So, it's not kind of I think rehabilitation should be a sharing of what we do, like we're doing now in this podcast. That's why it's just so amazing. Yeah. Where, you know, other centers might not want to share their skills or their expertise. And, you know, I think that's not the great way to go because we can really help each other learn. And it's so important for what we do.
I am 100% in agreement with that. Is that, sometimes it's hard. It's sometimes, you know, it's hard to put yourself out there and say, I've got this question, or I'm not sure if I did this correctly, or what do you think? Most rehabilitators who are on the receiving end of that question are generally open and eager to help and non-accusatory, right? Because we're always concerned. We don't want to be pointed fingers at and things like that. Nobody does. But yeah, we're better together. And I totally agree with that. But today... we're going to talk about Canada geese.
Yes.
So why do you like Canada geese as much as you do? Because I know they're one of your favorites.
It is my absolute favorite bird of all time, animal of all time too. I like white-tailed deer too, but my favorite bird for sure is the Canada goose. And when I tell people that, they act like I'm on fire or something. And they're just, you know, like, what is this dude doing? And so it's a long history with me and this bird. So I've loved all birds since I was little. I remember begging my dad when I was probably five to get a pet bird. I remember specifically what he was doing, where he was at. And I'm like, I want a bird. And so eventually he brought a cockatoo home for me. And I just always loved birds. And I remember going to the park and feeding ducks, you know, bread like we know shouldn't be done. And we all did it when we were kids. And we are, as educators and rehabilitators, are trying to like, hey, don't do that. That's bad. But I remember doing that, you know, going to parks and stuff. And I just always loved that species, and for so many reasons. And I remember when I was a kid, I think it was in 1993 3 maybe. Fly Away Home was in the theaters.
Movie.
Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
I actually went and saw that movie in theater with my dad. So I remember it was so much fun to do that and to see that movie. And I remember also I was still in high school. There was a catalog that my dad would get where it had like hunting and fishing and like outdoorsy kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I remember they had a sweatshirt with Canada Geese. It was a red sweatshirt with a big V flock of Canada Geese on it. And I asked my parents to get it for me for Christmas and I had it. And I felt like such a nerd, but I loved it. And it's just, I've always loved Canada Geese. And it's two things when you say something, when you're talking to somebody and you bring up Canada Geese, what are the two things they say negatively about Canada Geese? There's two main things.
Yeah, they poop a lot and they're loud.
Well, secondly, next to love being loud, they're mean. They always say they're mean.
Oh, they're mean. Yes.
So
yes.
One of our volunteers here, when one of his first days, I said, we got to give this goose a match. He's like, oh, and he kind of rolled his eyes. I'm like, all right, let me give you an example. I said, say you're at the park with your family and a stranger runs up and picks up one of your siblings or starts to mess with your siblings and your parents react. Are they being mean? Are they defending your siblings? And he's like, well, they're defending him. I'm like, exactly. Canada Geese are not mean. They're good parents. That's a huge difference. So that's one main thing I always tell people is, you know, everyone that doesn't like geese has a story about being attacked when they were a kid. So if you think about it and you ask questions, what were you doing? Where were you at? What time of year was it? It's always in the spring near a nest or near a pair that has newly hatched goslings. Mm-hmm. And you were too close and didn't listen to their behaviors, which we'll talk about. And then you got either attacked or hissed at. And that is still considered attack to some people, which it isn't. And then that bird gets a negative connotation. And that's not fair. They're incredible parents. And that's one of the main reasons why I love this species so much. Just their bond with their flock and just everything about them is just amazing.
Yeah, I love them too. I mean, a couple of my favorite things about geese, so I'm going to just put that out here too, because, you know, I like Canada geese too.
Yes.
Partly I like them because a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. Partly I like them because they were an endangered or threatened species for a very long time. And a lot of people don't even know that anymore because it's such a success story. Mm-hmm. But I really love hearing them in the fall when they're flying and they sometimes will fly pretty low and you can hear their wings sing and they will honk and talk to each other love it. I absolutely love it. And I'm not really much for fall, but that's the thing that I love about fall is listening for the geese.
Absolutely. And same with me. Fall's always been my favorite time of year. You know, that's when all the geese are migrating and, you know, it's cooler outside. I don't like the heat. So it's cooler outside. My birthday's there, Halloween. So all the fun things happen in October. and that's one of the things is watching the geese set in into a pond or a lake for the evening. It's a beautiful experience. I'll sit there, record every flock coming in on my phone and just replay it. Like it's amazing. It really is amazing.
I also like when they're actually just landing. Mm-hmm. I like swans for this too, right? So they're just landing. So they've got, you know, they've got their landing gear out and they just hit the water and that noise from hitting the water with, oh my gosh, I can't get enough. It is amazing. Absolutely amazing. So, well, of course you and I could go on and on and on about why we like these animals, but I want to get back to the main we're going to be talking about fostering.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could define fostering and then pros and cons of fostering.
Mm-hmm. So fostering is giving an orphan gosling to a foster family. That's really what you're doing. And so you admit an orphan gosling at your center. You can raise it in captivity. But we know that there's certain species that are very prone to being imprinted in our care. That's corvids, you know, white-tailed deer and geese. And also to great horned owls, if they're not, you can correct me if I'm wrong on that, Gail, but great horned owls can be really imprintable if they're not with other birds and stuff like that. You have them too long when they're too young. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's that. And, you know, you could either care for them for 8 weeks in your care, you know, with the risk of getting them too imprinted or habituated, which is, you know, two different things, which is very interesting to think about and look into, because it's a total different thing. It's really, really interesting. I didn't realize that until a couple of years ago, where I really started talking to Lisa Fosco. She's a rehabber in Ohio, and she's been all over. I know you know her.
Yeah.
I was talking to her about some imprinted mallets we had. She's like, "Well, the imprinted habituate." I'm like, I don't know. What do you mean? And so we start talking. I'm like, that's really interesting. So, you know, so you could do that and raise them in captivity and risk them imprinting and then all the food and all the poop and all the cleaning and all the work. Or you just give them to another family and they take them. That's it. And then they're in the wild where they belong.
Right.
And that's, in my mind, that's the best option. I am all for fostering everything that we can do. Kestrels, barred owls, you know, songbirds. We foster as much as we can because it's just better for the animal. It's more work sometimes. And luckily I'm a goose nerd. And because I've watched geese for so long and watched their behavior and then trial and error, you know, the fostering thing, I've learned the hard way on certain things and learned the easy way on other things. And so that's why I've been able to get a pretty good fostering protocol.
All my protocols
are in my brain. They're not really on paper. So I know my boss and all my coworkers are like, you need to write that down. I'm like, I know. So then you reached out to me originally and said, hey, let's do a MOU or what was it? A SOP on Woodcock. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, let's do that. And you're like, you know what? This is too much fun. Let's do a podcast. I'm like, yes, I'm in.
So you have backup and we now have a standard operating procedure for Woodcock that other people certainly can improve upon and all that. And that's on our website. So there you go. And then backup, we've got you talking about all of the pieces and parts and all those details. So, so you can go back and have someone listen to this and say, this is the SOP for fostering geese.
Yeah,
so just briefly, I just want to say that for folks that may not be as well versed in like the words imprinting or habituation, imprinting is a permanent process. It's a natural process. And I kind of think of it as like a shortcut to let the bird it's almost always birds, but there are mammals that also imprint. But it's a shortcut to help them kind of know who they are, who the adults are, know what they're supposed to sound like, things like that. It's not that they can't learn after they've been imprinted. They certainly can, and they certainly do. But it's a permanent process. And it's not just, I open my eyes and I imprint on anything that I'm looking at. It takes a little bit of time. Sometimes it's a very short amount of time. Sometimes it's a little bit longer. And at some point we'll have a podcast just on imprinting and habituation and tameness. But habituation is you're kind of getting used to something. You know, the person shows up with the food bowl every day, doesn't try to catch me, doesn't try to scare me, doesn't try to eat me, doesn't try to whatever. And oh, okay, so food's good. So Tim is good because he's been bringing that food all the time. And that's habituating. And that's why in city parks, if you've got geese coming up to people who are feeding them bread, which we again know isn't the best, they learn that, well, the person that's walking up to me like this or sitting on that park bench means a free meal. Whereas in the field, maybe, or outskirts of the city or farther out, you wouldn't be able to approach, or those geese wouldn't approach you either. So that's just down and dirty on kind of the differences between that. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
No, that was perfect. Yeah, okay. You hit it perfectly. Yeah.
Okay, great. Great. So, there's some cons in fostering, right? And is it always, we're going to be talking about introducing a gosling to a foster family, so unrelated. But do you also bring them back to their own family?
Yeah, so that's actually the most ideal because then, you know, like we'll talk here soon, there's little intricate things you have to do in fostering to make it successful. And if it's the original family, that's the best case scenario because the parents already know each other. And they know the babies, they're the same size, it works out perfectly. And actually we had a gentleman call last summer and he said he found a gosling orphaned in this area. And he said, I can't find the parents. So I'm like, where are you at again? He told me, I was like, okay, I know exactly where you're at. I said, go down this road, turn left, the parents are gonna be right here. And he went there and literally that's where the parents were. He put the bird down and we ran it right with the parents and it was perfect. He called me back, he's like, oh my God, that was perfect. He's like, you knew exactly where they were at. It was so great. And it's like, well, I'm a nerd. I know where these flocks are. And that's one of the other key things we'll talk about is you have to know where all the local flocks are. But I knew where that group would have been out of a couple of places. And he went there and found the pair and did that. And so I don't urge the public to foster on their own because there's so many things involved with the public, as you know, as a rehabilitator. How many eagles were brought in to us as babies and they were robin chicks? Like a lot,
you know?
And so, you know, not to not trust the public, but I generally don't, because often they when they're saying, oh, I have a duck, I can hear the goose on the phone. I'm like, well, I can hear it. That's a goose. That's not a duck. So it's just better to have the bird brought to your center to evaluate, make sure he's okay, make sure he's not injured, make sure it's waterproof, all those other things we need to do, because it's easier for us. We have that innate instinct and the experience to know what's right, what's wrong, what's going on. You know, I can see a post online and say that bird's sick, and 100 people will argue with me. And I said, no, I'm telling you. And then the bird dies and they're like, what happened? I'm like, I told you guys that bird was sick. And so we just have that training and that instinct and that experience to know, you know. And so it's often tricky to have the public do that, unless you have someone that really knows, like that guy, you really seem like he would be able to figure it out. And if it didn't work, he would bring it to us right away. And so, you know, there are certain cases that I'll have the public do it, but it's rare because of the situational stuff involved in fostering.
Right. They have good intentions, but also at the same time, they also have that, like we were talking about earlier, the background of geese are mean, you know, don't like geese. I can't get close to them. And they also overestimate, maybe. I think we all do this in different areas, but they overestimate, like, no, I was within 5 feet when actually they were within 30 feet. And that happens all the time. And like I said, for folks not in wildlife rehabilitation, I know it happens to me in other areas. So I'm not trying to demean anybody at all.
Oh, no, of course not.
At all, because lots of good intentions. But I agree that if we can get eyes and ears on the animal and then really, we can help this gosling a little bit better. And then we know.
Well, right. We have it in our hands. And that's why, you know, like, you know, people often call and say, well, how, you know, what's wrong with this animal? I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm not seeing it. So, you know, it's like, if you call the doctor and say, hey, what's wrong with me, doc? He's going to be like, well, I don't know, cause I need to see it. You know, like it's so that's kind of the example I give often to people. And it's just better for us to look at it, even if it's for 2 seconds, like, look, well, everything's good. You know, here's what you do. The animal can go back where it came from. If it, you know, it's just an orphan baby or just a baby that was, you know, found alone, like the, you know, fawns or songbirds and stuff that are supposed to be on the ground at that age. You know, but like every situation is different every time. So that's why it's so important that we handle those cases, those calls.
Oh, exactly. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about Canada geese natural history. So what kinds of, I'll just turn it over to you, because I'll just take over, you know, because I like geese too. So let's talk about their natural history.
It's just an amazing bird. I'm going to say that probably 50 times, like I did in our woodcock podcast, about how awesome they are. You know, so typically they're a very flock oriented bird. They're always together in big flocks or small flocks, depending. And here in Ohio, they're almost at every city park or place that has a pond. And so they're always together from, you know, like basically like when they have their babies and are older to the early winter, late winter. And then March, you kind of start seeing pairs separate from the flocks. And so generally a pair of geese won't nest or pair up or breed until they're into their second year. And I'll tell you a cool story about that later. But we had, so you have, you know, a pair that's an adult pair. They're over 2 years old, and they will leave their family flocks and then separate and go to almost always the same location they nested in the previous year. So when you have older birds that have already nested before, they're going to go back to their same territory. It's always at a mall or a car dealership or, you know, a school at the front door, you know, and it's always that. And so, or on rooftops now. And I'll tell you why I think that's evolving. But they always go that same nest location, usually in end of February, March, depending on the time of year. And they're claiming that territory, and they're honking, they're loud, and they're claiming that territory. And then they nest. And so, you know, to give a little bit of natural history about nesting, Canada geese lay around 5 to 7 eggs in a clutch, and they incubate for about 28 days. And then They lay an egg a day until there's that full clutch. And then, you know, the female, the goose, will cover the nest with the down, and she'll still keep near. And then once all the eggs are laid, that's when she'll incubate solely. One thing I always try to educate on is they don't need to be fed. They gain a lot of body weight and fat before they're nesting. So actually pre-nesting, when you're looking at a pair of geese in the field, you'll see the female's bottom is real round and distended. It's real chunky. She builds up a lot of fat reserves for this incubation process. So, you know, post humans being here in North America, or European settlers, really, they did this on their own. So they don't need us to feed them. And so that's one question we get, or we go to a mall and you see loaves and loaves and loaves of bread all around this nest. It's all rotting and moldy, and there's a little bowl of water there. And that's not good for many reasons. One, it attracts predators and scavengers to that nest.
Right.
And two, it causes bacteria and all kinds of other things that aren't good. So, you know, they don't need they don't have to eat at that time. She builds a fat reserve so she can sit that whole time. She'll leave once a day to relieve herself and to eat and to drink and bathe and do her normal thing, but she goes back pretty quickly back to that nest. So there's no need to feed them. And so she'll be on that nest for about 28 days. And then once the baby's hatched, it takes around 24 hours for the babies to hatch and get dried off and get mobile. And then in the past, typically most of the Canada geese that are nesting are going to nest right on the water source or near the water source they're going to raise their babies at.
Okay.
But we know with duck species, they nest far away from water and they walk their babies that long distance, mile or two or more, from their nest site to the site they chose to raise their babies.
Mm-hmm.
Canada geese are different, and I think there's a couple natural reasons why that is. One is they have two parents to protect their babies, so and the nest site, so it's a better chance for survival. So that's why they only have half the amount that mallards would, because you have both parents caring for them, so there's a higher success of survivability. And two, they're larger bird, just like a swan. They're a larger bird, so they're more defensive of their young and their nest territory. And I think all adds up to it being easier to just nest there, and then they're right at the water source because they can pretty much hold their own on anything that comes to that nest except coyote. Even mink can be pretty rough on them too. But coons, raccoons, they can defend the nest against foxes for the most part. But sure, I've seen videos where, you know, a coyote walks up, those geese are back in that water, like, take the eggs. You know, we know that that's going to be an end result for us. So, but mallards, they'll hold on that nest until death. And that's just a survival technique. So that's the one thing that they'll do. So they'll nest, have their babies, and typically they're on the pond that they want to raise their babies at. This is a theory, and I don't know, and you could let me know. I think we may have talked about this. I know other goose nerds that I'm friends with. So there's a lot of hate with this species. And as we've talked before, they poop too much. They're too loud. They're too mean. But we create everything they need for their life. So if you go back way in the early 1800s or 1900s, like you had mentioned, in Ohio, Canada geese were extirpated. They were gone out of the state. Hunters eradicated the species. We killed them all off and they were gone. When the reintroduction happened, we actually reintroduced the wrong subspecies. So the subspecies we introduced was the Branta canadensis maximus, the giant Canada goose. And I believe, and I could be, I'm pretty sure I have the right interior species, subspecies used to be here, and they were heavily migratory. But the giant Canada goose are not really heavily migratory. So they don't need to leave like the interior birds do. So that's why we have Canada geese here year round for the most part. Now we have the migrants here now, and I can tell you the difference about how to tell those from the local birds, as we'll call them. So you have that pair that's at that pond and you know, that's where they were normally, but now, cause you have there's many companies out there that are hired to scare the geese away. They're goose chaser companies. And so what happens is you have a beautiful wood plot with, you know, 100 acres of woods and a pond and a stream. And then we level it as humans to put a mall or a subdivision there. It's in their code to put a retention pond because of the drainage. you know, the forest and nature has a natural, amazing way of reducing water flow. And you know, it's just how the water flows. It doesn't flood. It kind of soaks in the ground slowly. And that's how nature does it perfectly. But because we leveled all the forest and put all this cut grass and cement, the water just, it floods. And so it's part of the process involved to make a retention pond. And us as humans, for some reason, I disagree, but we love cut grass. We love open, expansive, huge acres of just cut green grass. And that is exactly what these Canada geese feed on. That's what they love to feed on. So historically, they would, you know, be at the edge of the water where the bison would be grazing or other native, you know, animals like that. And they like that shortcut, tasty, fresh grass. And that's what they feed on. They feed on, you know, aquatic vegetation too, but they really, really feed on that shortcut grass. And that's what
they're grazers.
Exactly. They're grazers. And we provide that everywhere. And so because of all these, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I mean, the whole city here in Ohio, where in Cleveland, where I'm at, is totally changed from what it was when I was a kid. And that's, you know, that's, it's sad to see, because all these woods I used to explore when I was a kid are gone, and they're malls, you know, it's just, so these birds have nowhere to go. Animals have nowhere to go because that habitat's taken away. But there's certain species like Canada geese and coyotes and white-tailed deer can really take advantage of that and adapt to our urban sprawl and do pretty well. And so what the geese are doing now is, because you have these companies that are chasing the geese away, they're adapting and they're nesting farther away from water, like the ducks do.
Okay.
And they're walking their babies back to the water source, and they often nest on rooftops, on hospitals and other places. And then the babies just jump down, just like the ducks do, and wood ducks and other cavity nesting waterfowl. Mm-hmm. And they just, the babies, then they walk, the parents walk to the nest where they would normally nest originally, that where they want to raise the babies. Mm-hmm. But they're still getting into trouble with the dog chasing companies. And so, you know, while I'm not a fan of it, of course, I'm more of a fan of that than the roundups. I don't know if I'm sure you know what the roundups are, but
they used to have them in Minnesota.
State federal agencies will round the birds up during June and they're euthanized because there's too many. So it's the chasing, hazing thing is definitely better than that. But, you know, I always say we're creating that reason they're there, and then we're blaming the birds for it. That's not fair.
Right. And habitat, like you just mentioned, habitat is everything, everything. Yep. And when you have an adaptable species like a coyote or like a Canada goose, they, you know, you build it, they will come. And, you know, if you've got the food source, you've got the water source, you've got possible places for shelter and all that kind of stuff. Yep. They're going to be there and try really hard to be there. So,
yeah,
I agree. We've got, and, you know, maybe we're doing better in some respects, riparian areas and building corridors and building those bridges, those natural bridges over freeways and stuff and things like that. But hopefully, you know, we can learn a lot from these common species that are now common, and they've done very well around us. And that's one of the reasons that they are now common. Mm-hmm. And I had not realized about the reintroduction of the giant Canada geese instead of the interior Canada geese. But that's, you know, even the interior ones, if the water stays open because you've got a aerator and things like that, if food's available and they have access to water, why leave? They got thousands of feathers on them to keep them warm.
They do. And that's another thing that I always talk to people about when I'm talking about birds and waterfowl in general, is that they're going to gamble and try to stay as far north as they can to get to the breeding grounds as quick as they can to claim territory and breed, but they're gambling it. So if you get a big freeze, like we had on Lake Erie in 2013-14 winters and 14-15 winters, where the Lake Erie was 99% frozen, those birds that were gambling here lost, and a lot of them died, and a lot of them came to rehabilitators, and we were able to release them. But it's a gamble, and that's just nature. You know, they're trying to, you know, to gain that, you know, basically pass on their genes and produce young, and so that's what they do. It's, you know, it's geese a little bit easier. They're larger, but I think the larger the birds, it's easier because they can pack on more fat, and they have more of a chance, more time to really kind of sit with no food, whereas some of the smaller birds, like, you know, redbirds and mergansers or redhead ducks or things like that, they, you know, they're smaller birds, so they're, you know, they lose body weight a little bit quicker than the bigger birds. So
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's a gamble staying. It's a gamble if you do migrate and you come back too soon.
Right.
Or it might be right on time, but all of a sudden there's a massive spring snowstorm or something like that. And a lot of warblers face that, right? Because they're also doing the same thing. It's a race against time to get back up here and pack on lots of food and have their eggs and feed them all the tons of insects we have in the north, you know? Yep. So, okay. Well, so this is, I love that hypothesis, you know, and maybe somebody listening will take that on as a project, or maybe you can figure something out with a citizen science project or something.
It could be. And I actually talked to our folks here at the Division of Wildlife and said that, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit, but these geese move all over the place when they're flightless. We'll talk about that, why they're flightless too. But they move and they travel so far. It'd be really neat to see where they're really going with GPS transmitters or something. It'd be really cool to learn.
Right. Identification. I wanted to, you said that you could tell the difference between the different subspecies of geese. And I wanted to talk about males versus female, because when you look at them, their coloring looks pretty much the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Canada geese are not sexually dimorphic like mallards are. So they look, you know, identical in the way they look, you know, phenotypically, they look the same, but there are a lot of different differences on how to tell a male and female. It's real easy in the spring when you have a pair guarding territory. Males are generally larger than the female. They have, you know, bigger chest, kind of a, you know, more muscle up there. And if you have a pair pre-nesting or during nesting, during egg laying rather, you'll see a pair in a field or near a pond, and the male's generally, his head is up and he's looking around. His head's up, he's alert, he's paying attention, while his female's just feeding. She's just feeding to gain that weight, to gain that fat reserves so she can incubate for the you know, the 28 days. And that's one easy way, is that the male's generally the larger, he's taller, he's a bigger bird. But one thing that people don't realize is that their voices are different. So females hink and males honk. So that's kind of a quick way. They do a lot of different vocalizations, little barks and murmurs that they do. But generally, when you hear a flock flying over, you hear that high pitch hink and the lower pitch honk, that's male and female. And so that's kind of how you could sex them in the field when they're flying over, when they're in a flock. It's their voice. It's really interesting.
Cool. That's so cool. Yeah. And how do you tell the difference between the subspecies then?
So that's a little bit, that's a lot trickier to do. And I don't know if we see a lot of subspecies here in Ohio. We do get interiors here, or lessers, they call them. Mm-hmm. And we'll rarely get cackling geese. And so there's, correct me if I'm wrong, there's 7 subspecies of Canada geese and 4 subspecies of cackling geese. And so different parts of the country have different, you know, their migration kind of goes different flyways. And so, but in here in Ohio, we typically will see, I believe it's Richardson's cackling geese, which is rare. And then we get the giant Canada geese, the Branta canadensis maximus. And then the interiors or the lessers will come through during the winter, and you'll see them. So they're a little bit smaller. They're a little bit more petite than the giant Canada goose, but really there can be a huge variation in the giant Canada goose. Anyway, you could have, I had one bird one time, I was sure it was a male. This bird was monstrous and then laid an egg. So I'm like, okay, well, I was wrong on just visually looking at that bird. So it can be really, really different. But generally that's how you can tell, is they're very similar in the way they look, but the size and the weight of the bird can vary, but on average, most Canada geese, the males that we get in are like 4,000, 5,000 grams. Okay. Females are like 3,000 to 4,000 grams, probably on average. But then when you get a lesser in, you know, and you, I think I had one that I was kind of second guessing might've been a lesser. It was like 2,800 or something, 3,000 as an adult. So, you know, you can kind of tell by weight, but are they skinny? Are they not skinny? And so it's variable, but it's, you know, it's pretty tricky, but typically you're going to see giant Canada geese in Ohio.
Okay. I have a weird question.
Sure.
I don't know if it's weird or not, but You know, when geese lay eggs and they're on the side of the pond, let's say, their eggs are white.
Mm-hmm.
They're not camouflaged. You know, like some songbirds have spotted eggs, and although robins have bright blue eggs, go figure. But, but a lot of ducks, some duck eggs are completely white, like mallards, but some duck eggs are not. So what so about geese? Why white? Is it?
And I never really thought about this, but my guess is they don't have to be colored because they're covered with the down when they're not in the nest.
Okay.
And they're out foraging, or they're still egg laying. The nest is not going to be open. It's going to be covered with the down that she pulls from her keel during incubation. So
okay.
She'll pull that real fuzzy, warm down off of her chest, and she'll cover the eggs before she leaves. Mm-hmm. So that's camouflaged with the feathers.
There
so
you go.
My guess is that they don't need to be camouflaged because they're not in the open. And other ducks that are cavity nesters, same thing. They don't need to hide because they're in a hole.
Right.
But I don't think there's any duck eggs that I could think of that are patterned because, like I said, they're all going to be covered. Where if you have a killdeer nest or a woodcock right. nest, they don't use material
right, to cover their nest.
Geese and ducks don't really make a nest per se, but they do have a nest. They'll gather whatever kind of stuff is nearby, in a swamp or a pond. They'll have cattails, mm-hmm. Shoots and roots and leaves. Mm-hmm. So they'll pack that around the nest, and then they line it with the down fur, and so that's probably why. That's my guess.
Okay, I think that's I like that explanation. I think that's great.
It's not a stupid question at all. That makes you think.
Yeah, just like I wonder, but yeah. No, that, and it fits right in their natural history. So that might not be the exact right answer, but it might be spot on.
Right.
And I think that's a good working hypothesis. I love it. Love it. Okay, so. A little bit more on behavior before we get into why goslings come into care, because mm-hmm. that's, of course, when we interface with them, right?
Right.
So some of the behaviors that the adult geese show are defensive, right? We're defending the chicks. I'm defending my territory, that kind of thing. What do those behaviors generally look like? And do they have an order of which they exhibit those behaviors?
They do, actually. So, and there's different variables. So, when you have a question about this specific topic, it's not always easy because there's some pairs that are very territorial and will not allow any other birds on that pond for mm-hmm. the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
And there's others that are tolerant of other pairs within their territory, but on the edges of the territory.
Okay.
Or they're just used to that situation. So typically in an ideal situation where you're going to foster, when you're fostering Canada geese, the ideal scenario is you have a location with multiple families. That's the best case, which we'll talk about later.
Okay.
But you'll have certain situations where you have just one pair of geese on one pond, no other geese around. That may be just a very, very, a territorial pair. I remember when I was a kid in the 90s at Tri-C College, I would go up there and look at the geese and ducks every year. There was one pair on these three little finger lakes there in the campus in Parma. And that bird was so territorial. I watched him fend off a red-tailed hawk, like probably 200 yards away from the pond itself.
Wow.
He flew up at that hawk in the midair over the road and chased that hawk out of the territory. And
wow.
I never forgot that. And so that bird, they nest in the same exact location under this little tree at the edge of the mm-hmm. pond. The female had a little bit more white on her cheek, and I knew who was her. And by his behavior, I knew it was him. And they never let any other goose on that pond ever, mm-hmm. other than that pair of their babies. But other, like one of our main fostering spots here on a private residence in the area, there's multiple families, but they'll nest farther away on the same property.
Okay.
And they'll go to the pond and they have a certain area that they're allowed to be on. And so there's tolerance there. So it can vary on pond to pond. But typically what I've seen in any situation is when the goslings hatch, the parents are very, very, very territorial with any other geese within that first week of the babies being alive and moving around. They're really tall. They're really small. They're really vulnerable to predators. And so they're very alert and very, very mm-hmm. aware of their surroundings, very territorial within that first week of life with those kids.
Okay. So how is that exhibited? I mean, you explained the one, which was in a whoa extreme case, but do they hiss first? Do they lower their head, neck out, and wings out? Then they run forward, then they fly at the other one. What do they do?
They do. So typically the first behavior you'll see when you have, a pair of geese that have babies or a nest, but let's just say babies, and you have another pair on the other side of the pond, and they're kind of walking near that pair with goslings. The first behavior that I remember that I can think of noticing is they'll fluff their wing feathers out. And that's a, I'm mad, you better pay attention and back off. And so geese know this behavior. Many people don't, but right. Geese know that as a, you know, hey, you better back up, I'm uncomfortable.
And the noise you made, is that from the wings or their voice?
It's from their wings. Yeah, the wings fluffed it, and it kind of fluffs it up, and you know, kind of like with the hawk rousing on the glove. It's kind of like that, but it's more of a direct kind of. It's meant to show, hey, I'm uncomfortable here. I don't like this. I don't like you coming near me. Mm-hmm. So they'll do that, and then if the bird doesn't listen, they will. The male and female will lower their heads in aggressive posture. So they'll head pump, which we'll talk about in a little bit, but then they kind of keep their head down for a second. They'll have it down low. And if they become really, really like about to explode and run, as you said, their head's going to be low. Basically their chin is going to be horizontal with the ground. Their head's going to be down along the ground, and they're going to put their head out, and they're going to run straight at the target that they're trying to chase away, whether it's another goose or humans or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's back off. I'm uncomfortable. And then they'll fluff their wings again. Then they'll walk back to their female. Mm-hmm. This is the male that's typically doing that. And then they kind of go back, and he'll head pump with the female, basically saying like, hey, I'm here. I got you. I'm comfortable. I'm taking care of you. And then he'll, you know, look over at that target and basically say like, hey, you know, you better back up. So, and it's hard to do this over an audio kind of.
Yes,
you know,
it is.
And so I'm going to do a fostering videos. When next time I do a fostering class, I'm going to get videos put together, because I have videos of all this, and really show the details and pause and explain what's going on. So it may be a little bit harder through a podcast to see that. But if you know goose behavior and you're a rehabilitator, all these make sense to you. This podcast might put it all together like, oh, that's what I need to do, or that's how I figure
right.
it out.
Right.
You know,
right.
And so it's really interesting, you know, watching these behaviors. And so that's kind of the situation you get into with the aggression with the parents.
That was Tim Jasinski, wildlife rehabilitation specialist at Lake Erie Nature and Science Center in Bay Village, Ohio. I hope you enjoyed the first part of our discussion, because we will be back in episode 6 with more, starting with wild fostering of goslings. We touch on important topics, including avoiding misimprinting, ensuring the birds are ready to be on the water, socializing goslings to the flock, reading goose body language, and more. So see you again real soon. Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the partnership coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Klocke. Special thanks to our guest Tim Jasinski, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.